So Doug, part of your justification here for continuing and landing is that you know you're at the LNAV minimums. And I'll grant that if you were flying an LNAV approach here, you're exactly where you want to be. There's nothing wrong with being here. But would you know that? Like, do you brief what the LNAV minimums are just in case? And in this moment where you just had this near disaster and you pop out of the clouds, would you have the presence of mind, you think, to say, oh, I'm on the LNAV version now?
That's a great question. It really is a good question. And, you know, I must admit there are times when I perhaps might forget it. But what I certainly teach in flying all of these approaches that will have vertical guidance, number one is, when will I find out whether I get vertical guidance or not? And if I don't, what do I have to do? And so that is part of my briefing. So it might require a glance down quickly to see, you know, as I level off, ooh, Jesus, protect me, or am I okay? But I would have briefed it prior to starting, because that is part of, you know, as Bruce and I were talking earlier, how do you brief an approach? And you know, so many people read all the data, but don't think about, when should I find out what kind of approach guidance I'm going to get? And if I don't, what am I going to do? And we need to be prepared for that every time we fly an approach.
Does your answer hinge on knowing that you're at the LNAV minimums, you're at a protected altitude? If you didn't know that, or if you didn't have that number to back you up, do you think you'd continue then?
To be honest, I'm still, you know, I'm there in visual. I really do not want to go back up into the clouds. And so, yes, I would probably stay there and continue in, even if I didn't know that I was protected by the minimums. You know, there might be a tower out there in front of me. There might very well be an obstruction that I might not see. I don't know how fast I'm going other than my ground speed. Will I have time to see it? I don't know. But I'm not a gambling man, but I'm in visual right now, and I really don't want to go back up into the clouds in this situation. Mm-hmm.
There's still a little bit of a mystery about what happened and why, and you just almost killed yourself in IMC, and you take what's in front of you.
Exactly. You know, a bird in hand is worth two in the bush.
Mm-hmm. Dave.
I don't think I would have the situational awareness to know what the LNAV minimums are. When I broke out of the clouds in this situation, I'd just be happy that I was visual. I would do as Doug just said. Psychologically, it would be really difficult to climb back into the clouds. I would want to stay visual. And although I wouldn't have the situational awareness to know where I was exactly on the approach plate, I think I might have the situational awareness to be looking at the G5s and tracking my ground speed and comparing that to the indicated airspeed. You know, typically the G5s do show ground speed, and I would like to, you know, when I spotted that discrepancy, you know, I think that I'd notice that, hey, airplane's flying fine, engine's running fine, that this at this attitude and this power setting, you know, the ground speed is believable. And just a quick aside, the angle of attack indicators on piston GA airplanes are tremendously susceptible to this sort of same sort of pitot icing, as are the primary flight displays, especially the experimental panels. Pitot ice will make them read inaccurately. The one habit that you can get on using pitot heat, this pilot put pitot heat on before leaving the ground, but it's a really good practice when you apply pitot heat to glance at the ammeter and look for that spike that tells you that the heating element should be drawing current.
Yeah, great point. Bruce.
In this situation, you've basically created what's apparent on a few approaches out there in the system, which is this fly visual segment, where they have you fly a published procedure to an MDA typically, and then you hit a fix, and then, okay, now you can continue toward the runway, even if you can't see the runway, as long as you have the prescribed visibility, and the altitude is your discretion. These are usually done in mountainous areas where, for a variety of reasons, a normal approach design wouldn't work. But you're essentially doing that here. You've broken out. You're close to the runway. Maybe you can't quite see the runway yet, but you're continuing. Now, it's not technically legal in this situation because those minimums aren't published for this approach, but that's effectively what you're doing. So it's a little good indicator that there are these oddball approaches out there where this is actually normal.
But you are on your own in that.
You are on your
segment.
You have to have the required flight visibility and be sure that you're not going to hit anything, but you don't have to see the runway environment. That's the key.
Give us an example of an approach like that.
I think one in Reno. There used to be one at Hoquiam. I think they've changed that procedure since then. But if you look under in the AIM under fly visual or visual segment. I think if you just Google, if you just search for that in the AIM, you'll find the description of that.
Eagle Colorado has one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of surprising to me that you guys, you think your reaction would be in this situation to stay visual, because I feel like when an approach goes bad, what you're trained to do is go mist, right? Climb away from it. And I feel like looking out the window and seeing this terrain rising into the clouds next to me, I don't know that I would trust where I am at that moment, and I would power up and go back into the clouds.
Well, that puts you in the minority.
Apparently it does, yeah.
You just haven't done enough scud running in your life.
But I feel like that's what I'm getting at here, is I feel like there's a difference between on paper what is objectively the best thing to do, because you are at LNEV minimums, it makes a lot of sense to land, versus what I feel like my actual reaction in the moment would be.
You wouldn't have practiced this much, right? Your training was all about you hit whatever decision point is or whatever, now you go missed. And we need to be a little more careful about making sure people understand what that means.
I can think of almost nothing more scary than trying to do a missed approach with basically a partial panel. I mean, going back into the clouds, missing some key data while you've got P factor torque and a bunch of other stuff working that's all working together to just screw you up. And so going back into the clouds in a situation like that, I think would be really unnerving and really very dangerous. Had this happened, I think, basically in level flight, before you started the approach or something like that, you notice the airspeed going down, all that sort of thing, like completely different story. Because then you can figure out what's going on, you know your power settings for different phases of flight and all that sort of thing. But to be now visual and having to execute a missed approach back into the clouds, I think would be very difficult.
John.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the first reaction probably would be to go to full power. You know, you want to stop the descent, get the nose level, and you're on center line. So just continue straight ahead, hold your breath for 30 seconds, and you'll see the runway. You know, there's approach lights, there's a VASI. You're probably going to see the VASI as soon as you come over that little ridge and be like, whoa, man, that was a close one. But you probably got all of 30 seconds or so before you're going to see the runway.
Bruce?
Well, there's that, and then there's also, I still don't know what caused this problem.
True.
And I could now get airframe ice. I think that I don't have any airframe ice. I can't really see it, but I've just scared myself by popping out of the clouds in this steep descent. My heart rate's already up. I don't need to go back in the clouds. And then I'm certainly not going to go off to some alternate 100 miles away, not knowing that I maybe have tailplane icing or what. So that just adds to the fact that, yeah, I'm visual. It's not great. I'll may have to explain something to somebody, call this number after I land, but I'll be on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point that we don't know that this is an iced up pitot tube. It sure fits the symptoms.
With both
but
indicators
we can't see
out.
It, so, yeah, exactly. And there's no ice on the airplane otherwise that we can see. So, JP.
Yeah, I told Doug early on, this is the one that I was reading through it, and it gave me a little bit of anxiety because you could almost picture yourself being in this situation. And at first, it's going to be just a bit confusing because it's like, okay, I'm on an approach now. What's going on? The airspeed's not reliable, but I've got a visual here. And, it's not all that exciting when we all agree that we do the same thing. But I think we're all on the same page that when you're trying to mitigate the risk, it is less risky when you're in a visual situation, the head back in IMC with no airspeed indicator. And the other thing that we see here, when you look at the approach, if you do have that lateral guidance, there's a lot of obstacles on that plate, and you get a little to the right, a little bit to the left, there's antennas, there's terrain, things like that. But if you're on that approach and you have the wherewithal to see that you are at LNAV minimums, you should be in good shape to continue on until you get the runway. Certainly, I think I would feel a lot better continuing on than going full power, going back up there and somewhat be disorienting or not even know what's really wrong with the airplane causing that problem anyway.
So let's say now that you didn't have the presence of mind to know that you're on course and at the LNAV minimums, or maybe you didn't even break out of the clouds and you just got lucky and recovered it. You power up, you climb back up. What are you guys going to ask for now?
In that case, I would probably go back and probably do the approach over to Harrisburg, closest long runway. Going back to Capital City again you know, you're halfway between the two. It's probably closer to go straight into Middletown.
And is that the longer runway? Is that what's attractive there?
Yeah, well, you're going in that direction.
Sure.
I think one thing to consider here is it is critical in this situation that you do know your performance numbers. And if you don't know your performance numbers, you're really pretty screwed in this situation. If, as you asked, you know, if you come down and you haven't seen anything, you know, I would certainly probably head over to the other side of the river and go to Harrisburg International, but I need to know my numbers. And you've got everything else except the airspeed. We've got G5, so we can't put a suction cup over them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask for is I want a sticky note. Because yeah. It's if I have a sticky note that I can cover up the airspeed indication with, then that would help fly it with ground speed.
Yeah, the G5s, I was surprised to hear that. My impression was that in a situation like this, there would be logic to detect that there's probably an issue here and X out the airspeed. And what we heard from Garmin is, no, unless the air data computer fails, it's not going to X out. It's just going to behave just like the mechanical airspeed indicator next to it. And I think people think that these glass instruments are, you know, they handle failures better because they X out information when it fails. And in this case, that wouldn't be what happens. Bruce?
Well, I think getting back to, you know, did you break out or not? Here's an even trickier situation, though. You break out, but there's maybe some mist or, you know, other obstructions. You're below the deck, below the ceiling, but now you might encounter reduced visibility as you continue. And that would make it much more challenging to decide I'm going to continue. This also brings to mind like a contact approach. You don't have to see the runway. You can, as long as you have the required flight visibility, can stay out of the clouds, you can continue whatever path you choose to get to the runway. So it's kind of similar to those, and why those are challenging if you really don't know the area and you don't have confidence in your ability to remain visual.
I want to talk about the way this approach was flown in the first place, right? This was a high-speed approach, definitely not the textbook stabilized approach. Was this the right way to fly an approach in potential icing conditions? Does it help that there was an autopilot to fly it?
Another good question. It is debatable. In this scenario, the pilot had thought it through, knew what he had to do. My question would be, had the pilot practiced this before? Because it certainly, we could not define this as a stable approach.
Right.
It is anything but a stable approach. Is it doable? Yeah, I believe it is doable. But I certainly would probably want to practice these a few times in VMC conditions with a safety pilot on board as well. To be very honest, before I would do it for real.
Doug, do you think the conditions warranted such an extreme approach? With the temperature the way it was and everything, it almost seems like this pilot made more trouble than it was worth by flying 140 knots and with the speed brakes out and everything. I don't know,
I can't answer. I'm not really sure. I mean, I'm certainly an advocate. If you know there's ice out there, you want to get down through it with as high a rate as is feasibly safely able to do, you know, to minimize the exposure. I'll turn to the meteorologist to my left.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to do.
Yeah, I think, you know, the temperature has ticked back up to minus 13 Celsius, so it's warranted that you could get some airframe icing in that scenario. I would have flown, I'm a Mooney owner myself, I would fly that approach pretty fast. And I don't think 140 is that bad. Depending on what flavor of Mooney you have, you're either within gear speed or getting close to it, that you can get the wheels down and you can start getting slow. So I would do the same thing. I think that's the best course of action, because you are in really kind of that ice ripe zone of the clouds there and airframe icing. And we all know, you know, any airplane that doesn't have ice protection, you don't want ice. But a Mooney especially, that is a bad recipe.
Is there a temperature below which you would say, you know, you're comfortable taking your Mooney into the clouds because the ice potential is so low? Or is that not a, can you not use that simple of a criteria?
There's a lot of variables in that. Yeah. And you're absolutely correct. You can get so cold that you just don't have the moisture in there for ice accumulation. But, you know, if you get colder than minus 20, minus 30, something like that, it's almost like what you're starting to deal with in the flight levels. You're not really looking at an ice zone, but when you are around minus 20, minus 10, minus or around zero or a little bit plus, you are in an ice ripe zone. That minus 13 is where you don't want to be.
So now you're going to do this approach again. We're back to the situation where you don't get what you want. We climb back up. Do you use the same strategy now without the airspeed indicator? Because now you're kind of flying outside of your performance numbers, I would think, right? Coming in fast, using the speed brakes to slow down. Or do you just deal with the potential for ice on take two? How about you, Dave?
Yeah, you know, I don't fly a Mooney regularly, but maybe a good question for the Mooney pilot is where does ice typically show up first? I mean, if I hadn't seen any sign of structural ice on this, then I think I'd be tempted to just fly a normal approach. You know, if I had seen signs of structural ice, I think I'd want to go elsewhere. So, I would think that, as has been previously said, this approach, the way it was flown, doesn't seem terribly far out of bounds. You know, slowing from 140 to a landing in the last 2.5 miles seems plenty doable. I would just want to satisfy myself that this was just some little bit of pitot ice and not a more serious structural ice situation.
Sure. Yeah, and use ground speed as a proxy for airspeed. Add a little buffer, maybe take the long runway, right? JP.
And the other thing, if you're going to use ground speed, very important to be thinking about the winds. What's ASOS said, okay, query the controller to make sure. I mean, if you know you got a 10-knot tailwind, you can do a little interpolation there and figure out what you're going to really be, what your airspeed's going to be. I think that's an important component. And maybe I missed this in all of this. I know we're suspecting pitot ice. Do we have pitot heat on?
Pitot heat was turned on before takeoff.
Okay.
Yeah, so presumably it failed in the pitot tube iced up, but we don't really know that.
Yeah, so we're flying with some unknowns here that we don't know if we got a larger problem than just a pitot tube that's iced up.
John.
So if you want to go back to the original reason why I think we all decided to try and stay visual, in January of 2020, there was an accident out in Aspen, Colorado with a Cirrus that took off in snow in a fairly low ceiling, lost the airspeed indication. They went into the clouds briefly. Pilot lowered the nose, got back out of the clouds, got so confused that they pulled the chute and just landed off airport that way. I think you can't underestimate the confusion factor that would come about from trying to, because it's basically the same thing. This missed approach would have been basically the same thing as a departure climb. And you're in and out of the bases with no airspeed and, you know, we don't have a chute.
I remember back when I did Malibu Mirage initial training quite a while ago, and the instructors there were really hammering on pitot heat being on anytime there's visual moisture, period. And it went back into the early years. In fact, the first year, I believe it was the first year of the Malibu, the 310P with the Continental engine, there were 4 fatal accidents. And every one of those accidents was attributed to the fact that the pilot had neglected to turn on pitot heat. And ever since I did that initial training, there's moisture out there, pitot heat is on, period. And you start looking at now the airplanes that are coming out, even this new, I've gotten to fly this Piper 100i. I'm not too thrilled with it. But there is a pitot heat annunciator in their annunciator panel. When I did some flying with the PC-12, there's an annunciator for pitot heat. And if that annunciator is on, it's a no-go. And I see a lot of pilots, you know, those older Cessna 172s, if there's visible moisture and it's below 40 degrees Fahrenheit, consider putting on pitot heat.
And those Malibu accidents, presumably those happened because the airspeed dropped to zero, the pilot pushed and the plane came apart, right?
Well, in some of them, I believe that the assumption was that the airspeed indicator was acting like an altimeter.
Right.
And they were getting slow. They were told to descend. They're getting slow. Ooh, what do you do when you get slow? You push the nose down. Oh, it's still getting slower. Add some power until airframe failure.
And we have another kind of data point on that, a video that a client of yours, Doug, showed us where she's flying along an IMC. We'll put this in the hangar, by the way, so you can check out this video yourself. But she's flying along in IMC. You see the airspeed drop quickly to zero, and her immediate reaction is to push. And within seconds, the VSI is pegged, and the airspeed has dropped 500 feet, or the altitude, rather, has dropped 500 feet. And she breaks out of the clouds, fortunately, and recovers it. But it's kind of shocking how quick it all happens and how quick her reaction is to just push, and things just go off the rails quick.
Yep.
Bruce? Well, back to your question about if you did the approach again, would you fly it with the same profile? And I would say no, because I don't want to be in that steep descent without an airspeed indicator. You know, if I've practiced this, I've probably had all the instruments working when I practiced it. I'd want to go back to, okay, what's my, what I call my happy place for a normal sort of approach? I'm going to stay there just to give my, because it's not even just so much that you might see a zero airspeed and push. You could get disoriented in many ways and end up, you know, pulling up and stalling, or, you know, there's all kinds of ways this could go bad.
And again, it goes back to knowing the performance
knowing your numbers.
And
absolutely.
If you know those numbers, now we're not doing a makeup, you know, dive like a kamikaze.
Well, it's what
we know the numbers and we can fly it stabilized.
It's what most of us teach, I hope, even with primary VFR students. At some point, you make them fly a pattern without an airspeed indicator. To just, and it's not so much about airspeed indicator failure, it's about this principle of knowing pitch, power, config equals performance, right? That's the key.
Another thing that might have saved the day here was the low altitude alert that the pilot got. John, can you tell us, how are those triggered?
Those are triggered by descent rate. So the radar system looks at the mode C altitude and says, if you keep this rate up, bad things are going to happen. It's basically what it does. It doesn't know what approach you're on. Doesn't know minimums. All it looks at, there's boxes. It breaks up the final, actually the entire airspace into boxes. But the boxes are much smaller on a final approach course. And there's a minimum altitude for each box. And if it projects ahead that this descent rate will penetrate one of those boxes, then it sounds the alarm.
There's a VOR approach at an airport, a towered airport near me, where every time you fly it, if you descend a little bit aggressively, the tower chimes in with a low altitude alert. And right. And if you fly it with a student, then they're like, are we okay? What do I do?
Yeah, that was very common on dive and drive type of non-precision approaches, because the computer says, hey, if you keep this up, you're going to hit the ground.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest takeaways from this is that these sorts of instrument failures are not like practice, and this is a really hard thing to practice. I mean, you certainly can't just cover the airspeed indicator and say, go for it, and get the same reaction that people actually do in reality when this happens. And you know what gets you is the transition to the failure. And what this pilot could have done to prevent this from happening is nothing, right? It's the old saying that you should wind your watch in an emergency, and it applies here too, really. The autopilot's got it. It's flying towards the runway on the glide slope. Just take a moment, figure out what you're working with, and go from there.